the so-called justice system in my country, Australia, has failed.
An emotional human rights claim. It's Tuesday, June 15th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You'll find us online. We're at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, COVID's future for cities. COVID crimps Cambodia's cow dancers. Donkeys head to China. Afghanistan's last Jew. Pictures of joy. It's all on today's VOA Asia. NATO leaders have designated China as presenting systematic challenges in a summit communique Monday. The statement marks a forceful stance for the Western military alliance, declared a priority for U.S. President Joe Biden after his predecessor Donald Trump decried NATO. In a diplomatic victory for Biden, he urged his fellow NATO leaders to stand up to China's authoritarianism and growing military might. The NATO final statement called China a security risk to the Western alliance. The language will set the path for alliance policy. On Monday, the group of seven industrialized nations issued a statement on human rights in China and Taiwan. Beijing said that statement slandered its reputation. A United Nations human rights claim is being made by an Aboriginal mother in Australia over her son's death in custody. Daniel Dungay Jr. died after being restrained by five prison officers in a prison cell in 2015. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
"I can't breathe" were among the last words spoken by David Dungay Jr. Video shown at an Australian inquiry into his death 6 years ago documented his final moments. He was struggling to breathe as he was held face down by a group of guards at Sydney's Long Bay Jail and injected with a sedative. The 26-year-old Indigenous man was being restrained by officers trying to stop him from eating biscuits because of fears he could fall into a diabetic coma. The inquest later found that none of the guards should face disciplinary action. No criminal charges have ever been filed over Dungay's death. His mother, Letona Dungay, and a team of high-profile lawyers have argued Australia violated her son's human rights and failed to protect his life. Having campaigned vociferously in Australia, they're taking their case to the United Nations, filing a complaint with its Human Rights Commission. Letona Dungay says the UN must be told about a crisis in Australia's criminal justice system.
"I will not stop until I get justice for my son. My heart bleeds for him every day. The so-called justice system in my country, Australia, has failed. Failed me, my son, my family and my people. I'm going to keep fighting until we live in the country where black lives matter."
Letona Dungay's legal team is also seeking to put pressure on the government in Canberra over its record on Indigenous deaths in custody. Aboriginal Australians are among the most incarcerated people in the world. They make up about 3% of Australia's population, but almost a third of prison inmates. While Indigenous prisoners don't die at a greater rate than non-Aboriginal people in custody, they are vastly overrepresented in the criminal justice system. Since a historic inquiry into Aboriginal deaths in custody in 1991, at least 474 Indigenous people have died behind bars. Australia's Attorney General's Department has said that 78% of the Royal Commission's 339 recommendations had been fully or mostly implemented. However, those statistics are disputed by some Aboriginal organisations. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
These are among some of the top Asia headlines you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. Deposed Myanmar leader Aung San Suu Kyi on trial for corruption. Blasts on buses in western Kabul kill at least seven, according to police. Australia outlines bold moves to ban single-use plastic and coffee cups. Filmmakers worry Hong Kong film censors will stifle expression. U.S. offers alternative to China's Belt and Road Initiative. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and so much more when you visit us at Facebook at VOA Asia and stop by the voanews.com website. We have more VOA Asia for you right now. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. With the coronavirus pandemic easing in the United States, discussions are underway about what people want their communities to be like post-COVID. Urban planner James Rojas is leading a workshop to explore these ideas, as Deanna Mitchell reports from Oakland, California.
So welcome to our COVID workshop. This past 14 months has been a really trying time for everybody. It's also been a learning time for everybody.
For urban planner James Rojas, how people feel about their environment is what matters.
So this workshop, we're going to attempt to capture all these kind of feelings, emotions, and learning that we had from this pandemic.
Cities, neighborhoods, and families adapted to the COVID-19 pandemic. Now with society starting to open up, many are asking whether things should go back as they were or should changes stay. As a gay Latino, Rojas has built his career leading workshops like this one that aim to give a voice to those who are often underrepresented in discussions of city planning, such as women, the gay community, immigrants, and people of color. He uses found objects and Black Sea designs to spur conversations about feelings in various environments.
Okay, are you guys ready to talk about your pre-COVID life?
I feel like I was on some sort of track without having any idea where it was going. It was just kind of going.
That's just life.
Rojas asked people to build a city based on positive memories.
You know, that memory that you had when you were a kid is the first time you ever felt connected anywhere. And that's what you want to achieve for the rest of your life.
Rojas and his partner, John Camp, have experienced their own pandemic shift in perspective and how they work and live. For one thing, they embrace doing their workshops online, something they would have never considered in the past.
Because people are in their safe space and they share these stories that are really intimate.
It seems like people are coming out of this with a much greater sense of what really matters to them.
People tell Rojas they want more time with family, craft making, walking outdoors, and working from home, something he thinks may be here to stay.
This has been like a really great experiment in all these different new ways of working.
Oh, yeah. Spending more time outdoors during the pandemic has helped Rojas with living in the 350 square foot apartment he shares with Camp.
This is our treehouse. Nice views of the trees and the hills of Oakland. It's 350 square feet. It's plenty of room because we have plenty of connections to outside spaces.
Workshop participants also appreciate nature, yet note how the role of technology has increased.
We are outside together, but we're on a network.
Yeah, nature and technology.
The balance between the two.
Rojas hopes people can find the right balance for themselves, taking a few positive lessons from a challenging time. Deanna Mitchell for VOA News, Oakland, California.
Happening now in Asia, pro-democracy supporters took to the streets of Myanmar's main city of Yangon chanting, "We want democracy," according to social media posts. They marched as part of protests held Monday to coincide with the day the trial of Myanmar's ousted leader Aung San Suu Kyi was set to start. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad, as always, to have you with us on VOA Asia today. Thanks for stopping by. For 14 years, a Khmer classic dance troupe in northern Cambodia has distinguished itself with its embrace of spirituality. But the impact of the coronavirus pandemic may be ending the troupe's livelihood and spiritual identity, as VOA's Chetra Chap reports.
For most of their lives, these young Cambodian dancers have spent 6 hours a day, 5 days a week, learning, rehearsing, and refining the nation's classical dance and music. Born and trained near Cambodia's iconic 12th century temple of Angkor Wat, these sacred dancers of Angkor pray and meditate every day.
The sacred dancers of Angkor are children born in the land of Angkor. They're born around the temples from poor villages and with a very humble background. So it is fitting for them to serve the spirit of the temple.
Ravin Karet Coxon created the Prerium Bopardevi Dance School in 2007. Located 2 kilometers from Montesrai Temple, the dance school aims to revive Cambodia's cultural and spiritual legacy.
Performers and musicians here embrace very strict discipline. We are the only spiritual dance troupe in Cambodia. We had offered dedication and dance rituals to the spirits and deities in 42 Cambodian ancient temples.
Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, the dance troupe lost its only source of income, which came from its twice-weekly performances in Siem Reap, the city nearest the Angkor Wat temple complex. Without the monthly receipts of $4,000, the 25 dancers and musicians may also lose their sacred identity.
The sacred dancers who had since 14 years not broken the spiritual thread in praying and in meditating every day for the peace in the world, for all the children in the world, they embrace a spirituality that if you stop and you tell them, okay, now we have to close the school, we have to close the conservatoire, and then you come back when everything is okay, they will come back as normal dancers. But the spiritual thread will be broken forever.
Karet Coxon moved to Europe in 1970, 5 years before the communist Khmer Rouge regime took over Cambodia and killed some 1.7 million people in the late 1970s. Among those murdered were most of the country's artists, musicians, dancers, and educated Cambodians. The regime's savagery put Cambodia at risk of cultural extinction. Karet Coxon first returned to Cambodia in 1992, and 2 years later founded the British charity, the Ngin Karet Foundation for Cambodia. The organization helps over 2,800 village families who live within the Angkor complex, among them, the sacred dancers of Angkor. During the pandemic, she and her husband have been supporting the troupe with their own money while trying to raise funds for the dancers.
You have to also remember that Angkor Wat is listed as UNESCO treasure, but the classical dance is also listed as UNESCO treasure. So what we're doing, we're linking the two UNESCO treasure in the heart of our cultural heritage. This is very powerful. If I could find 4,000 persons who would give $1 a month till the tourism resume, we'd be okay.
Chatra Chap for VOA News, Washington.
After you listen to VOA Asia, you can see VOA Asia. VOA Asia is on YouTube. See and share the fun with Food Bites, our weekly culinary dive into foods from the homeland. Recipes that came with chefs who immigrated to the United States. Students enrolling in U.S. schools can get their first lessons about life on campus. Subscribe for free. See us often at VOA Asia YouTube.
This news from VOA Asia. The U.S. government is assessing a report of a leak at the Taishan nuclear power plant in China's southern Guangdong province. A French company and part owner of the nuclear power plant warned of an imminent radiological threat. You'll find this and all the big stories throughout the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As we continue with VOA Asia, donkey meat and skins are again being allowed to be sold to Asian markets. Kenya's population of donkeys is once again under threat after the High Court lifted a 2020 ban on donkey slaughterhouses. The high price for donkey skins for use in Chinese medicine has led to donkey poaching and fears the working animals could soon go extinct. Brenda Molina reports from Nairobi.
For years, women like Helena Simeon have relied on the working donkeys to ease the burden of labor in their homes and in their farms.
As women, we get our earnings from our donkeys. We use them to help us in our work. We fetch water with them. We carry luggage. We fetch fodder for our cows. And sometimes we sell them to earn money to educate our children.
This reliable source of labor is now under threat once again. In early March, Kenya's High Court lifted a ban on the slaughter of donkeys for both meat and hide for medicine in the Asian market. Now, Kelena is staring at an uncertain future for her and her family. The lifting of the ban is already causing ripple effects in the communities that rely on the animals for labor.
We don't like the donkey abattoirs being reopened. We would like them to be closed permanently because the last 2 weeks alone, donkey theft has increased. We are suffering.
Donkey slaughter was legalized in Kenya in 2012, leading to a rapid decimation of the animal's population and cross-border theft of the same.
There were very many issues that were coming up of donkey thefts, of slaughter of underage donkeys, of cross-border even smuggling of donkeys. But most importantly, communities were losing their livelihoods because the abattoirs were slaughtering very many donkeys a day, much more than naturally the donkeys can replenish.
The Kenya National Bureau of Statistics said in 2019 that the country's donkey population had decreased over the previous 10 years from 1.8 million donkeys in 2009 to just 1.17 million in 2019. This figure is now expected to decline even further with the lifting of the ban to slaughter the most significant and profitable domestic animals in Kenya.
So if you look at even our current population, if they continue slaughtering at that rate, which is too high, it will be a few short years before the population of donkeys in Kenya gets almost decimated.
Kenya has four donkey abattoirs spread across four counties. The four haven't resumed operations yet as they are waiting to get approved by the licensing authorities. When that happens, activists say the animals will resume their downward slide, presenting a real problem for rural women of the country and the region. Brenda Molina for VOA News, Nairobi.
Making headlines in Asia, for a second day in a row, a lone torchbearer was the only participant in the Tokyo Olympic torch relay during its stop in Sapporo in northern Hokkaido province due to COVID-19 restrictions in the region. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, Sabulin Cementov is believed to be the last remaining Jew in Afghanistan, but he plans to leave the country over fears that the Taliban will return to power after U.S. and NATO troops leave. VOA's Rahim Gulsaran visited Kabul Synagogue and has this report narrated by Roshan Norzai.
62-year-old Sabulin Cementov is believed to be the last remaining Jew in Afghanistan. During the Afghan civil war in the 90s, his wife and two daughters immigrated to Israel. But he decided to stay in Kabul now that the U.S. is pulling its troops from Afghanistan and the Taliban is growing stronger. Cementov says it's time for him to leave and return to Israel.
God willing, I cannot say 7 to 8 months, but I will definitely leave by the time the Taliban come.
Cementov has been caring for Kabul's only synagogue for decades. He says someone else will be hired as its watchman.
They know that I'm working on it, getting my passport and leaving. They can have a watchman, and then let's see what happens.
Cementov calls himself a proud Afghan. He believes that one day he can return.
This is my country. I was born here. I'm an Afghan. I have served two terms in Herat during Daud Khan's rule and also during Karmal and Najib government.
Once a thriving community in Afghanistan, thousands of Afghan Jews have left for Israel and Western countries because of the war in the country. For Imgul Sarwan in Kabul, Afghanistan, Roshan Nurzai, VOA News, Washington.
While the pandemic has been a source of grief, it has not stopped joyful events from happening, including thousands of babies being born in this difficult time. Photographer Ann Geddes, creator of the Joy Project, is encouraging women from around the world to send her pictures of their newborns for publication and a pick-me-up. Anna Nelson has the story narrated by Anna Rice.
For photographer Ann Geddes, a series of coronavirus-inspired lockdowns was a challenge. Constant flipping through newspapers, a short walk around the block, apathy. One of the best-known baby photographers had a hard time adjusting to the new reality. Geddes is known for unique newborn photos, sleeping babies nested in flower petals or flower pots or wrapped in cozy blankets. Her works reached the peak of popularity in the 1990s, when calendars of her photographs adorned walls in thousands of homes. As the quarantine period was extended, Geddes thought, enough, and she found a way to bring joy into the new reality.
Oldest daughter, our two daughters are photographers, wonder why, said, you know, why don't you think about spreading joy, because that's what you've done your whole career. And so we came up with this Joy series, and I had no idea that it would be so impactful for so many people, including myself. Because all I did was do one post saying, "Hi guys, while we all try to make sense of this global pandemic and we're all in voluntary isolation, which is where I am now, I just got to thinking, because I've had a lot of time to think, I've been in the spreading the joy business for the past 30 years. Will you help me to spread the joy around the world by direct messaging me a joyful photograph of your little one?"
Geddes hoped to receive responses, but never imagined she would be flooded with gratitude and thousands of pictures of babies born during this incredibly difficult time. What she thought would be a small collection turned into a collective heartwarming portrait amid the pandemic from more than 80 countries.
As a mother myself, who gave birth, you know, over 30 years ago, I have to take my hat off to these wonderful women around the world who are going through labour and birth, wearing a mask, often without family around them, often without their partner. I simply can't post all of them, right? Because there are so many.
But she found a way around that. Geddes created a subscription-based mobile app, a sort of a photo bank for baby pictures, where anyone can upload a picture of their little one and get a personal response from Geddes herself.
I would recommend to people is that they have themselves included in the photograph with their tiny baby, because it gives a sense of perspective, of course, when you see how small tiny babies are. But it lets your child see you when they're an adult as the age that you were when they were born. And it will allow them many years of mocking you for your hairstyle and your wardrobe.
Geddes believes baby pictures have a unique effect on people. Calming, heartwarming, bringing joy in the toughest of times.
And that's the power of tiny babies, yeah? You know, you can cut all the flowers, but you can't stop the spring. It's intense joy in tiny little pockets through COVID, but it's still joy nonetheless.
For Anna Nelson in New York, Anna Rice, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You can find us online. We're at Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. We thank you for joining us today. And we thank our service chief, Diane Gao, our VOA Asia team, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Amy Hybels. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a terrific day ahead. Be safe. Be well.